Well, I must admit, I have been a little hesitant about making this illustration in times past because everybody knows in every set of twins, one of them is the evil twin. And I thought, before having twin granddaughters of my own, that if I said this, one of the two Robin boys would get mad at me, but at least we'd know which one was the evil one that way. So I'll ignore them and just talk about my granddaughters, as all grandparents want to do. But of course, we have these two. They're not identical, but one is certainly the evil twin. You know, one's got a more calm disposition. The other one's always chewing on her sister and more demanding. And they named her Evelyn, but I'm sure everybody's going to pronounce it Evelyn for the rest of her life. But, well, all that, of course, is in good humor. But the problem with identical twins, of course, is you can't tell them apart when you're just looking on the outside. And although their behaviors may be remarkably similar as well, no two identical twins are identical in every regard. And so it's the heart, it's how they think and act on the inside that really will enable you to tell these two apart. Well, what does that have to do with our series we've been looking at? Well, you recall last week we revisited this issue of how just as Jesus is crucified between two thieves, the gospel is constantly being crucified between two competitors, two ways of supposedly relating to God that are false. And on the one extreme, you have those who say there really are no rules. Everything is relative. Truth is whatever it is to you. God doesn't really care about any of that stuff. You just kind of do your thing and God's cool with that. And that strips from the gospel its demands to be holy as God is holy and to be like Jesus. But then on the other extreme, we have those who make salvation a matter of one's own merit, that we've got to kind of pull ourselves up by our own spiritual bootstraps and save ourselves, and so that our good deeds are what will make God appreciate us or save us. And, of course, of these two competitors, they look quite different. Here's a person who's not really making any effort to obey God except on his own terms, just doing his own thing. But here's this other person who's being very obedient to God. And the problem is that on the outside, that person may appear to be following the true gospel. And so this morning, we're going to ignore the moral relativist off on the one extreme and focus on the true disciple of Christ compared with the false disciple of Christ, both of whom appear to be obeying God, but in fact there's a profound difference between their obedience. The one is obeying God as a means of saving himself, whereas the other is obeying God out of his gratitude and devotion to the Lord. On the surface, we're not going to be able to tell the difference between the two. And so here's a person who's going to church and they're singing songs and they're taking the Lord's Supper and they're donating generously, all of those kinds of things. But they're not true disciples of Jesus Christ. And even if we're not in that group, even if we see ourselves as being true followers of the true gospel, we need to understand that the tendency is constantly to drift in that direction. We place such an emphasis upon the need to obey God, and that's a proper emphasis, but that can easily lead us into thinking that it's by our obedience that we make ourselves favorable to God. Well, first of all, we need to identify what real religion, true religion, is all about. If we go back to the Old Testament, we see that there is this same kind of three different groups of people that you run into. There are the pagans, those that the Bible constantly describes in the Old Testament as uncircumcised. They did not practice this ritual that was a sign of the covenant that God had with Israel. And then there were those who made up the nation of Israel. And they were technically circumcised. They had followed the outward sign of the covenant of Abraham, but they weren't really circumcised. That's the problem. And so a passage is very typical throughout the prophets, Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 25 and 26, the last two verses of Jeremiah chapter 9. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, that I will punish all who are circumcised and yet uncircumcised. And it appears that what he means by uncircumcised, there are the Egyptians and the people of Judah and Edom and the sons of Ammon and Moab and all those inhabiting the desert who clipped the hair of their temples. For all the nations are uncircumcised, but I'm not really talking about them. I'm talking about all the house of Israel who are uncircumcised of heart. And so, yeah, you got that one category of the pagans who make no pretense of having any kind of relationship with the Lord. They're off over there. But here are those that are God's people that are circumcised. But he says, but you're really uncircumcised in the heart. And that's the same problem we're looking at here today. If you go earlier in Jeremiah, back to chapter 4, you notice that God uses this same kind of analogy, but now to state it from a positive perspective. Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 4, circumcise yourselves to the Lord and remove the foreskins of your heart, men of Judah, inhabitants of Jerusalem, or else my wrath will go forth like fire and burn with none to quench it because of the evil of your deeds. And you'll find those kind of statements pretty frequently in the prophets as well. And so the Bible recognizes three categories of people. Those that are uncircumcised, quite literally. Those that are circumcised in the flesh, but they're not circumcised in the heart. And then those that are God's people who are circumcised according to the teaching of the law of Moses, but more importantly, were circumcised in their hearts. And Paul makes this same point when we get to the New Testament in Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3, beginning of verse 2, beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of the false circumcision, for we are the true circumcision, who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in Christ Jesus, and put no confidence in the flesh. And it appears that the warning that he gives here in verse 2 are against those that are Judaizing teachers of some kind, and so he calls them dogs, because that's a term the Jews normally used of the Gentiles. But he says, no, you're the real dogs, or these Jews are the real dogs out here. And of course, he's not talking about a racial thing here. Paul himself was Jewish in physical terms, but no, he's talking about these who've made this religious commitment of devotion to the Jewish tradition, the old law of Moses, and had consequently rejected the Christ. They are the real dogs, evil workers. They thought the works of the law were the way that you made yourself approved of before God. But no, those are evil works. And their circumcision surely was a sign of their faithfulness to the Lord. He says, no, that's just mutilation. The real circumcision is that which we have in Jesus Christ. And you notice how he defines this. Paul could have gone on to say, because we keep the law better, we have better commandments and any number of things like that. But no, he says, we put no confidence in the flesh. And so this idea of seeking God, of being diligent and very fervent in our religious activity, that's not the problem. Many Jews were very religious and very fervent, very active, and thought they were seeking the Lord, but in fact they weren't. Because all of that seeking, all of that effort, wasn't following the true gospel of Jesus Christ. If we look in the book of Romans, we find a similar kind of point being made. Very typically, we look in Romans chapter 1 and see Paul's characterization of the condemnation of all Gentiles before God. Now, he's really talking all along about Jews as well, but he's writing it in such a way the Jew thinks he's talking about the Gentile. And then he says, beginning in chapter 2, I've really been talking about you Jews all along as well. And that leads him then to this grand conclusion in Romans chapter 3, verses 9 and following. What then are we, that is Jews, better than they, Gentiles? Not at all, for we have already charged that both Jews and Greeks are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. And he continues with the list of these Old Testament quotations. And so, but I want to look there at the end of verse 11. That's pretty striking because clearly there were a lot of people that were seeking God. Again, they were very fervent in seeking after God. You think of someone like the Apostle Paul before he became an apostle, before he became a Christian. He was a fervent persecutor of Christians. He was zealous for the law of Moses and the ancient traditions of his Jewish heritage. And if you had asked him, Paul, are you seeking God? Oh, yeah, with all of my being. Matter of fact, I really come out way ahead of other folks. I'm a Pharisee of Pharisee. I stand head and shoulders above my peers in seeking God. But the problem is, these people are seeking God as a means to an end. They're seeking God as something they can manipulate or control to bring out some desired result for themselves. Obeying God, in quotation marks, but really it's saving themselves. But there is none that truly seeks God, that is, who is seeking God as an end in and of itself. That we seek God because we seek to know God. We seek to have this relationship with God. And so what we're saying ultimately is that the difference between these two identical twins, these people that are seeking God, these people that are going to church, these people that are doing all kinds of religious things, the difference, you know, on the outside is not even discernible. But inwardly, there is a profound difference of their motive, of their spirit, of their heart, of their inner character. And so where do we find true religion? We find it on the inside of a person, in their heart, and whether it's been devoted to the Lord or not. And we also see this same kind of contrast frequently within the teaching of Jesus. You know, as Jesus went around, here's the tax collector. You remember we read from Luke chapter 18, here these two fellows go to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector, and which one is justified by God? Well, it's the sinner. You know, not the man who had all of his righteous deeds all lined up and rehearsed them to God. The one who goes away justified is the one who merely confesses his sin before God. Or the immoral woman, like in Luke chapter 7, again, at the house of a Pharisee. Well, you know, if Jesus knew what kind of woman this was touching him, he wouldn't allow it. Why is it that it's the tax collectors, it's the prostitutes, it's the morally questionable people that are always coming out on top? Because these are the ones that understand that true religion is found in the heart. And we're not suggesting that these people continued to be followers of Jesus and they continued to cheat people or they continued to prostitute themselves. It's that they turned away from these things to find the true gospel and forgiveness that Jesus was offering to them. Even in John chapter 3 and 4, where we see this clear kind of contrast between Nicodemus in chapter 3, this aristocratic man, leader among the Jews, very righteous man. And then here's this woman, again, a very immoral kind of woman, a Samaritan woman, in chapter 4. And she freely receives the gospel message from Jesus. Now there's hope for Nicodemus because a little bit later in the Gospel of John, he kind of sticks his neck out for Jesus. And at the end, we see him siding with Jesus in his death and helping with the preparations for his burial. But at least this first encounter in John chapter 3, you get the impression that Nicodemus, he's got to go home and think about it. You know. It didn't just freely embrace the message like the woman does. And again, it's kind of ironic that between the two, the one person that Jesus says, you've got to completely tear everything down that you have built, that your whole life and what it is unacceptable. We got to remove the entire thing and start over again. It's not the immoral woman he says that to, but rather Nicodemus. And surely that must have been shocking to him. Surely he was expecting Jesus to say, well, Nicodemus, there's one or two things you could improve on. But that's not what Jesus says. Nothing in your life is acceptable to God. And how many of us are like Nicodemus today? We think, surely I've been religious my whole life. I've been going to church my whole life. I've stayed away from all the fun stuff, you know, so I could be a good Christian. And yeah, I know I'm not perfect, and if Jesus were here, you know, he'd tell me, well, Tom, there's one or two things you need to work on. But surely he wouldn't say to me, your whole life is unacceptable. You got to bulldoze it and start over. But that might be the very thing Jesus would say to me. That's what I need to hear. Because true religion is found on the inside of a person and not the external behaviors and religious activities of what one has done. And of course, all of this reminds us in Luke chapter 15 of that story that Jesus tells about the lost son, or what we often refer to as the prodigal son. And it's a rather, you know, touching story. This father has these two sons, and one is just a complete reprobate. He has the audacity to come into his dad and say, I want you to liquidate the family assets and give me my share. And he goes out and he spends all of his money on prostitutes and everything else. But then there's that older brother. He's the good boy. He follows the rules. He does everything his daddy wants him to do. He stays there. He's a hard worker. And of course, there's two basic points to this story that Jesus tells. It's not that the prodigal son can come back and say, hey, Dad, I ran out of money. I need more money for prostitutes. And I figured, hey, it'd be better if I just lived here and that would save my money and I could have more prostitutes that way. Wouldn't that be great? No, this is a man who has repented and he regrets the foolish choices that he makes, and all he comes back looking for from his father is his father's grace and mercy. That's all he asks for. Not because he deserves it, but because he can't live without it. And that's the same way we are with God. We are absolutely spiritually bankrupt. We are less than bankrupt. We are even more in debt to God because of our sin. We desperately need his mercy to live. We don't deserve it, but we beg it from him because that's all we can do. But the other message of the story is the elder brother, who clearly is this Pharisee kind of person, who looks at the good deeds of his life and his religiosity and has concluded that he's a really wonderful person. Again, this is the tendency that we have, that we look at just how sincere we are as proof of our goodness before God. We look at maybe some powerful or profound conversion experience that we've had. That's the real proof that we constantly look to. Or perhaps it's more recently some religious performance that we've engaged in. Maybe we're a preacher. Maybe we're a great song leader. Maybe we're just a bang-up Bible class teacher. But something we've done or we do well that we can really look to and say, yeah, there shows what a great Christian I am. Or maybe it's simply that, you know, the frequency with which I just willfully rebel against God, shake my fist at God and say, forget you, God, I'm just going to do what I won't really do that. Very infrequently. So, yeah, I fall into mistakes now and then, but I never do that kind of stuff. But the problem is, in doing any of this, we think that's where we derive our feeling of self-worth or our significance or our value before God. We've got the wrong idea. And we've made this mistake of thinking true religion is found in these external things and not found internally in the heart where it truly belongs. And so if we understand that it is in the heart where true religion is to be found, then we understand that that's where the real transformation has to take place. And the danger of preaching a sermon like this is if people say, well, then going to church isn't important. Or singing and praying, that stuff's not important. Don't worry about studying your Bible. Don't put any money in the collection plate. No, those things are worthless to God. That's not what we're saying at all. Externals are important, but that's not the entirety of religious devotion, and it's not the major part of it. And we can transform our external behavior to bring it into compliance with certain rules and regulations, but only by truly changing the heart do we really change the real person. And you remember we noted Romans chapter 1 verse 16 before about how the gospel is the power of God to salvation. And we raised that question last week and noted that the gospel is more than just what's in it for me. You know, God has a plan for redeeming all of creation and has a purpose that He intends to use us in helping with that and sharing the gospel message with others. But also what is implied in this passage is that there's the power of transformation in the gospel, but where is that power to be experienced if not inwardly in the heart of a person? And so you think about this. If all we address are the external things, we are capable of making some kind of moralistic change in our life. So let's say I've got a problem with lying, or more commonly, somebody else has a problem with lying, and I'm going to try to help them with it. And so I might say to one of my kids, son, you ought to quit lying. Now, what am I going to do to persuade him not to lie? Well, I'm going to beat you. Well, that might help him a little. But there are a lot of motivating factors we can try to use. Fear and punishment. If you lie, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. People find out you're a liar, they're not going to trust you. God finds out, He's going to send you to hell. Or we might appeal to their pride. If you're a liar, you become just like those dirty scumbags over there. Everybody's going to label you. You're going to have a ruined reputation. No one's want to have anything to do with you. And I'm not saying that the Bible doesn't teach that. There are proverbs and other statements in the Bible that play upon those types of fears, punishments, and our need for self-respect and the truth of the kind of relationship we will or will not have with people because of our lying. But if that's all that we do, or that is the primary emphasis, and that's all that the person hears, we're kind of saying honesty is the best policy, and that is because it's purely in your self-interest to tell the truth, then what we wind up actually doing is playing upon their self-interest. But that's the real problem. The problem of us being sinners is the fact that we have such high self-regard, that we are so preoccupied, even obsessed, absorbed with self. That's the sinful condition. It's, as C.S. Lewis said, it's the ruthless, sleepless, unsmiling concentration on self that is the very mark of hell. And so how do you take that selfishness and try to kind of rehabilitate it somewhat into the service of the gospel without, to some extent, reinforcing that selfishness? And so what we can wind up doing is creating even more of a sinner than what they were before. Now, they may not lie as much. We fix that. But we've reinforced their selfishness inwardly. And they're now even further away from following Christ than they were before. I mean, you see people who will make even great sacrifices religiously. You know, I've known people that sacrifice great amounts of money, great amount of time, great amount of energy, really suffered greatly because of the enormous sacrifices they were making for their religious duty. But all of that is for nothing if ultimately you're doing it for your own sake rather than God's sake. Now, it's rather unfortunate that we have this kind of flippant expression, for God's sake, you know, this, that, and the other. And most people who say that don't mean it. But the Bible is steeped in this language of for God's sake. And all that we do is to be for the sake of God, not ultimately for the sake of ourselves. And so when we try to simply to take our self-absorption and realign it, reorient it in a different direction, we may be successful in somewhat restraining our external behaviors, and they're not as bad as they were before of whatever bad thing we were doing. But it's just like trying to bend metal. You know, some metals are just going to snap back the way they were before. You haven't really made any change, permanent change. Or some metals will snap altogether and break. And that's what happens to a lot of people. They reach the snapping point because there's only so far that you can get with this kind of spiritual brute strength. And we just keep kind of beating our head against a wall. Yeah, I'm going to stop this. I'm going to stop this. I'm going to stop this. And we can get by for a while, but then it doesn't endure in the long term. And what we will find people doing is they'll wind up committing some really atrocious sin that they could never have imagined them doing. They get caught up in adultery. And they say, I just can't believe I did that. I knew better. I wasn't raised that way. I'm not that kind of person. But the reality is that your whole life trying to live by this external moral standard was preparing you and strengthening you for that very sin. Because what you were doing was conditioning yourself really to be thinking and obsessed about yourself. And that is who you really are, whether you want to admit it or not. And so if we want to avoid merely changing things externally, moralistically, there has to be an internal transformation that takes place. And how do we do that? Well, again, I'm not saying every time you tell someone, you know, you've got to stop doing that because you're going to get in trouble. I mean, it's like in the Bible, you get this commandment says, don't commit adultery. That's God's rule. You don't do that. And in the book of Proverbs, it might say, you know, if you commit adultery, you might have to deal with an enraged husband who wants to kill you. You know, that's just a practical thing you ought to think about. Is that the sole motivator? Well, it shouldn't be. You know, if that's the one thing keeping you from committing adultery, that's a pretty good indicator of how weak you are spiritually. There's got to be more to it than that, and that comes from this internal transformation that takes place. And so I would encourage you to think about what Paul does, for example, in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. Now here, what Paul is wanting to do is to encourage the Corinthians to complete a collection that they had committed themselves to participating in and doing their fair share or whatever they had pledged themselves to do. God was interested in helping patch up this rift between Jew and Gentile, and so Paul is part of that. Wants these Gentile Christians to take up collection for these poor saints in Jerusalem. And you think about the things Paul could have said. He could have said, now I'm an apostle, and I'm telling you to do this. Just take a very authoritarian kind of approach, and they'd say, okay, Paul told us we got to do this. You know, grant or bear it, you know, whether we like it or not, we just got to do it. Or he might have chosen an emotional appeal to them very directly. Oh, think of these poor, starving Christians in Jerusalem and all their miserable condition and trying to play upon their sympathy for them. Not there's anything wrong with that. But again, that's not the primary motivation that Paul is interested here. He doesn't play directly and solely upon the peer pressure. Now again, I don't want to be misunderstood because there's subtle ways in which Paul does all of these things. It is very emotional. And he says, I could order you to do this, but I'm not going to. Well, that's reminding them of his apostolic authority. And he tells them what a great contribution the Macedonian brethren have made, and implying you ought to be ashamed of yourselves if you're not capable of doing as much or more than what they have. But notice what he says in chapter 8 and verse 9. Well, we might pick up in verse 8, I'm not speaking this as a command, but as proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. That's the more important thing. What's going on inside your heart? You know, I don't just want to get a sum of money here to Jerusalem to deal with some practical problem. That's not the main reason. But for what's going on in your own mind and in your own heart. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. He focuses on God's grace and lets that be the primary motivating factor. Because that's the only one that can cut to the interior of the heart and transform the person completely. And when we orient our thinking to God and what God has done and how merciful God is, then we will see real transformation taking place thoroughly and completely, even to the very core of our being. Why should I not lie? Well, yeah, I'll get in trouble. I'll ruin my reputation. People won't trust me. Those are all valuable and important things. But most of all, it is a betrayal of God, who is solely about the truth. In fact, he is so devoted to truth that he keeps his promises even at great cost to himself. And you see him hanging on the cross and bearing all that he does. That tells you everything you need to know about truth and lying and not keeping your promises. We might say the same thing about the book of Titus, Titus chapter 2. Paul here talks about saying no to certain things. I remember when I was much younger, I guess during the Reagan years, First Lady had this campaign against drugs, and the mantra was, say no to drugs, just say no. Well, there's a place for saying no to all of these bad things, and you think about all the ways we could say no to something. You're going to look bad. People are going to cast you out of your preferred social circle. You won't receive blessings from God. Matter of fact, he's going to send you to hell. You're not going to have any self-respect. Well, those are all, again, things that can happen because we do something sinful. But notice what Paul says, Titus chapter 2, verse 11, the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires, and to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Christ Jesus. So, we are taught to say no to ungodliness and worldly desires. Well, what teaches us to say no? It's the grace of God, ultimately, that teaches us no. Not a bunch of rules and regulations. It is God's grace that convicts us of what the real issue is, what is really the heart of ourselves and our devotion to God. And so as long as we view God as somehow the gateway toward getting our self-respect, finding our significance, finding our value in life, finding some purpose in life, and so God, again, is just the means to some end, we're going to think that we can somehow manipulate and use God for getting these things, and it's always going to be a form of idolatry. And we really need to stop and ask ourselves, what is it we're so needy about? What pride or fear drives us to be so needy? And that's why we've had this series of lessons about various forms of idolatry, because we could just back up and ask ourselves, what is it I'm really looking for? And what do I think I'm going to get out of this stuff? And if we could just weren't so needy and realize that God provides a much more satisfactory solution to our need than any pretender or counterfeit God in this world, we would be well served. And so again, whether it is because we're predominantly driven by our pride, is that constant confession that, hey, I'm a lot worse off than I ever thought I was. I'm a lot more sinful, a lot more broken than I realized. And that'll keep our pride in check and any kind of neediness associated with making ourselves somebody. Got to be somebody. Got to have my self-respect. No. But on the other hand, if it's some fear of loss and so on, well, but I'm more accepted and loved by God than I can ever have imagined. And so I don't have some anxiety or, worry about that. So I find my satisfaction in God. I find my self-worth in Him. The fact that He has forgiven me and that He loves me is enough. I like to have other stuff, but none of that stuff is important to me. I don't have to have it. I can let it all go because all that matters is God as an end in and of Himself. And I want to serve God and follow God. So once again, not saying that teaching our kids some of these moral principles and trying to change their external behavior is not not a good idea, because you're dealing with little kids and you're trying to shape them. And one of the things we're trying to do is to make decisions for them and say no for them, because their own wills are not sufficiently mature or strengthened yet to say no for themselves. There's a place for that, but when they're 20 years old, when they're 40 years old, they're going to have a much better reason, a more internal reason for not doing those things besides you're going to beat them. And we need to find those internal controls in the heart. And so it's like a little bird falls out of the nest, he can't fly yet. And so here comes the cat, I'm going to eat him. Well, he can say, well, I can't fly, so I might as well just sit here and be eaten by the cat. No, if he can run away to some little hidey hole and get away from the cat, that's great, you know, and he ought to do that. But if that's all he ever does, and he never learns how to fly, you know, he's always going to be on the edge of trouble. And one day he's not going to make it to his little hidey hole. His real solution is learn how to fly. And that's the same what we're saying here. And so, you know, I might get just so mad at Shane one day that I just want to haul off and deck him, you know? And I think, well, you know, I might lose my job. He might call the police. I might go to jail. He's bigger than me. He might deck me back. But, you know, I just want to hit him so bad. And if I'm not going to keep from hitting him for the right reason, I'm just going to go ahead and hit him. No! You know, if any of those things keep me from hitting him and doing the right thing, great! But I ought to at least know, you know, I need to grow a little bit more to where I have better reasons for not doing that, internally for controlling myself. And it isn't just about, well, I might lose my job, or what would other people think, you know. There's more to it than that. And so I hope that has been helpful to you in thinking of the difference between, you know, externally what appears to be righteous conduct and behavior and worshiping of God, but God sees a very profound difference from the person who's doing that as a means of idolatry, a means of using God, a means of obeying God as a means to some other end, versus those who've simply humbly given themselves to the Lord. And they seek nothing but God, and they found their every satisfaction and every need in God. We don't need idols anymore. If you will, take your songbook and turn to number 613. We'll sing that as a song of invitation, as a song of exhortation, as we think about our own relationship with the Lord. And as always, we're here to help one another. Not just externally to appear to be obeying God, but truly inwardly, motivating one another to be fully and completely devoted to Jesus Christ and following Him. That's all we want to do. And if we can help you in some way in doing that with us, let us know what it is we can do while we stand and sing the song of encouragement.